Welcome to Techniques of Persuasive Communications, cassette number 6 in Dr. Mortimer Feinberg's series, Practical Psychology for Managing People. Here's a powerful program you'll want to listen to again and again. It's jam-packed with dozens of techniques that will help you get through to people, get them to see things your way, and motivate them to do what you want them to do. What's more, you'll be able to accomplish all of this without resorting to orders and commands that only turn people off in the long run. Dr. Feinberg first dissects the problem of attitudes and explores the reasons why they are the major roadblock in communicating effectively and persuasively. By understanding the function of attitudes in everyday life, as well as on the job, you'll be able to deal with them more effectively. Then you hear about how you can use different approaches to most persuasively deal with individuals and groups of people, an important difference to understand if you want to communicate and get results. With these fundamentals in mind, Dr. Feinberg launches into a rapid-fire discussion of dozens of nitty-gritty techniques you can use to make your point and make it stick. These techniques will give you a proven, field-tested arsenal of powerful persuaders. Listen to the entire program from start to finish, but don't try to remember everything the first time around. Once you have a general idea of what is in the program, go back and listen again. Stop the tape after each technique and think about how you might be able to use it in dealing with problems you're facing today on the job. Let the techniques become a part of you and then go out and try them. You'll be surprised at how effective you can become when you use these techniques. Here then is Dr. Feinberg and his program, Techniques of Persuasive Communications.
Whether it be in writing or in speaking, the effective communicator will have a significant slight edge over his competition and will be more effective in his organization, in his family, and with his friends. So I want to talk to you today about communication. Have you ever tried to persuade a supervisor, for example, to transfer to another division? What about your boss? Have you tried to talk him into modifying a plan to which he had previously committed himself to? And that's one of the most critical, by the way, communicating with your boss. I have known men who have failed with very fine minds, primarily because they never sold their boss properly. Have you ever tried to talk up a great new program, one, and met with very lukewarm acceptance? If so, then you will agree that every businessman has a need to persuade people. The men and women who get ahead and stay ahead are the people who have the talent of getting others to see things their way, to convince them to take a course of action along the lines recommended. Harry Truman said that when he was president, one of his principal activities was, quote, to bring people in and try to persuade them to do what they ought to be doing anyway without persuasion. And Truman continued, that's what I spend most of my time doing. The trick, of course, is to get people to see it your way willingly. When you have to resort to commands and orders, you may encounter resistance. Certainly you can persuade people by threats, by intimidation, by brainwashing. The Russians have made great strides when they persuade people by brainwashing. Their technique, by the way, the Russians, is now known to us, is merely to isolate the victim from all stimuli, confine him to a bare room or an isolation booth, feed him only those ideas they want him to retain. And it has been proven that relatively over a short time, even a normal, healthy mind will crack. A fascinating aspect of this technique is that no physical coercion is involved. It's all mental, and that's why it's called brainwashing. Yes, you can persuade a person in your employ by following the same fundamental principles. For example, if you'd like a particular employee to resign, isolate him from all stimuli. Don't invite him to meetings. Cut him off from all memos that are going to be at his level. Don't invite him to lunch. Don't speak when you pass his desk. Don't route mail to him. Eventually, he'll get the message. I'm doing some work on outplacement, which is how you handle people who have been fired. And I'll tell you this, that it's much easier to fire the man and to send him to an outplacement agency than it is to brainwash him and to demean him the way this technique does. But it is done all the time. It's manipulative, and in my opinion, it's undemocratic, and in my opinion, also boomerangs. Another crude technique of persuasion is threat. Threatening a person, having him perform the desired manner, is easy. But again, it's boomerangs. It causes the individual to build up resentment. Also, a threat may be totally ineffective, depending upon the individuals. People have several ways of reacting to threat. They say, I don't believe that the forecast of doom will actually happen. It's improbable. He's exaggerating. It can't happen to me. So what? Even if it does, it won't be bad. I'm not afraid. Even if the worst comes, it won't bother me. Why is it so difficult, then, to persuade others? Why do we have problems in persuading others? Why do we have to use fear or threats or brainwashing or listening to this tape on persuasion? Primarily because people have rigid thoughts. Those rigid thoughts predispose them to a certain way of handling life. These predispositions to action have been labeled by psychologists as attitudes. I have spent 25 years of my life doing attitude surveys. I first started doing attitude surveys with the General Electric Company. In those days, and it was at the time when former President Carter was working as an atomic scientist. He was working on the atomic nuclear submarine. And we did interviews at the General Electric Company and at Westinghouse to find out why Westinghouse was making so much better progress in the development of an atomic submarine than was General Electric. The answer was the attitudes of the people. At the General Electric Company, there was too much of a division between the physicists and the engineers. At the Westinghouse Company, they worked hard on the attitudes of cooperation between the physicist and the engineer, between the theoretical scientist and the practical scientist. So I know how important attitudes are. What do attitudes do for us? Attitudes accentuate certain aspects of the environment. If you feel strongly towards your religion, whether it be Hindu or Catholicism or Judaism, you will tend to stimulate your interest in many things around you that are related to your religion. Next, attitudes simplify life. If you have a positive attitude towards academic people, you don't have to ask yourself every teacher you meet, I wonder if I like this professor. You have a predisposition towards all teachers. When you meet them, you know they have something in their favor. Attitudes simplify things so that your mind is always made up. You know, somebody said, don't bother me with the facts. I made up my mind. Next, attitudes, and once a man has an attitude, he will do everything possible to rationalize, to protect that position. The hell a man will go through to defend his position. Once you have made a decision, you will protect it. It's what we call cognitive dissonance. I referred to it earlier. It's an important concept in psychology. Let me use a non-fancy illustration. You want to buy a car, and you're divided. You're ambivalent. You're looking at two cars, a Ford and a Volkswagen. Finally, you decide on the Volkswagen. What do? Every car looks like a Volkswagen. You honk when a Volkswagen goes by. You say the Volkswagen gets 22 miles on a gallon or 38 or whatever. Attitudes are important to life. They have their place. Attitudes are prisms through which the world is filtered into your thinking. They help you focus on the world. They help you make sense of reality. Without attitudes, the world would be, as William James said, a whizzing, buzzing mass of confusion. Opinions are the result of attitudes. An opinion is the specific expression of favor or disfavor, reflecting the person's attitudes or predispositions. Now, how do you overcome these things? Everybody comes into the world not as a tabula rasa when you meet them, not as a blank sheet, but as something in which life has written a text. And let's say you want to change that text. The most effective persuaders are those who appeal to the heart and the mind. the heart and the head. Those who combine intellect and emotions as their listeners and try to persuade. I think it's important to recognize that you do not influence individual behavior the same way as you influence group behavior. Let's first talk about group behavior. How do you influence groups rather than just individuals? Hitler obviously was a mass communicator of groups. He seemed crazy to individuals, and he was crazy. Let's review the fundamental principles of persuasion to groups, as outlined by Dr. Mark Silver, a friend of mine who is now in private practice in Chicago. And Dr. Silver summarizes these principles as follows. First, in a situation where you want to persuade a group to follow your lead, never attack the group. Single out the leader if you can identify him and concentrate on his attitudes. If you win him, he will help you influence the others. And winning this one man will be far easier for you than trying to win a dozen men who in their unity find strength. Second, keep in mind that you can use the rest of the group to your advantage in working on the leader. Collect opinions and attitudes from the group. Perhaps the individual never had a chance to express himself. You might suggest that the leader collect opinions or facts from individuals, then funnel them to you. This accomplishes two things. It preserves the leader's dignity and alerts the group to the fact that a change may be forthcoming. In persuasion, never forget that the man who contributes to a final judgment will work hard to make that judgment a good one. Now, I want to concentrate for the rest of our session together on individual persuasion, because that's really where most managers, most men and women, have to do their job of convincing others, as Harry Truman said, to do what they should do without having been convinced. And I have 20 ways to do this. So hold on to your seats. It's going to be a rocky couple of minutes here, or half an hour or hour, as we go over these 20 points. Principle one, like in lovemaking, in persuasion, you got to get the subject ready. Call it psychological make ready. Printers have a process they call make ready. Before anything goes on the press, cutout paper backing is applied to even the pressure on the type and obtain a uniform imprint. In overcoming resistance to change or in getting people to accept an unwanted assignment, you have to pave the way by following a policy of psychological make-ready. Preconditions, or better yet, predisposing subordinates to accept the non-routine can be achieved if you plan your action step by step and pursue it patiently. This applies to blue-collar personnel and sophisticated executives with equal force. Here's a case study borrowed from experiences of a new plant superintendent in a print shop. On his arrival, his predecessor, who was reluctantly departing for retirement, warned him explicitly, "Don't ever ask the men to put in overtime. They'll turn you down cold." Came the inevitable occasion. The firm had contracted to print the city's government annual budget. One of the stipulations called for delivery by express date and hour with a severe penalty for each day of delay. Aware of his problem, the plant superintendent mapped out his program of psychological make-ready. Monday noon, in the laboratory during wash-up, he said casually to a group of men, "Think we can make the Thursday deadline on that budget. We'll pay a forfeit if we can't deliver." He got only vague answers, but he suspected the men would talk about it over lunch. And he was absolutely right. "Monday, at the end of the shift, I'll be staying late, fellas. I want to have a look at the proofs that are ready." Tuesday morning, we got a call from the city hall asking how we're doing in the budget. I said, "Okay, then we'll make it, fellas." Tuesday afternoon, we're getting close. "Could any of you fellas stay tonight for a couple of hours? Or would it be more convenient if you planned to work tomorrow night, Wednesday night, a full crew of volunteers were at work? The superintendent was successful in alerting his people and changing their position towards overtime because he kept in mind three factors. A, he alerted them to the problem well in advance. Alert people to the problem well in advance. B, keep the pressure low. 3, give people a choice on how they can resolve the problem. On the executive level, the same conditions prevail. A company president, knowing he would have to ask one of his subordinates to move to a distant branch, laid out his make-ready in this fashion. Here are the recommendations. First, about a month in advance, he raised the question at a staff meeting. You know, we're going to have to send somebody over to the coast. He knew this would start his people thinking, and the initial step was underway. The man he wanted had been alerted. Next, though he had received no feedback from his opener, he called in the man. There was no pressure, just a statement. I hope you'll be thinking about it. This elicited questions of fact, but no hint of conclusion. A week later, the two sat down for a thorough talk out. The president began with the statement, of course the decision is up to you. He knew it was important to give his subordinate an out. The man was good enough to be sent to the coast. He was good enough to be retained in his present spot. The conversation turned to a detailed examination of the pros and cons with all the factors hanging out, as the kids say. But still no conclusion. Naturally, the subordinate had to take back a report of this discussion to his wife, whose personal interests also had to be served. The final step, of course, was the man's active decision. Whatever the outcome, it was essential that he should know that he was not blackjacked into something he didn't want. Better make do with a temporary vacancy than fill it with a man who's permanently disgruntled. In any case, people are need and should deserve an opportunity to debate and decide on matters that affect their interests. Now, I spent a lot of time on this one point on psychological make-ready, primarily because it is the critical point in all of persuasion. It has inherent in that one recommendation fundamental recommendations that will help you in doing all of these, what I call mental acrobatics or mental exercises. Second, recognize individual differences. Do you know what stimulates your most important subordinate? What makes them tick? Do you know what kind of proposals leave your employees cold? What proposals stir them and bring them to life? Take into account what kind of man you're dealing with. Does he like a summary first and then details? Does he like the details first? Does he like a folksy approach or a sophisticated explanation? What is the background of your audience? What are their group identifications? In one famous study, in an actual industrial situation, it was demonstrated that a financial incentive program designed for all female employees would not work because of group identifications. Extra money was a terrific incentive for girls of Norwegian descent because in their families they were permitted to spend their own money. But for girls of Italian descent, money was not the right incentive. The girls, by family tradition, by the way, this is true of Italians as well as traditional Jewish families, going back 50 years ago, were required to throw their money into family funds, into a group pot from which they drew allowances, no matter how heavy their contributions, no matter how hard they individually worked. Bear in mind the democratic process. In weighing individuality, is it possible to give your people a choice? Wherever there's an option and people are given the opportunity to choose according to their individuality, chances of winning their support are excellent. Another illustration from my own personal research. 25 years ago, I was called in by the Grit Company. They are little newsboys who sell in small towns of this country. They sell the newspaper. The question was, how could we cut down turnover among newsboys? What were the characteristics of successful newsboys versus unsuccessful newsboys? In our research, which we studied over 20,000 young boys, we found that the boys who stayed were the boys who had retained, who had a higher level of retention, who had lower turnover, were boys who were able to spend their money as they saw fit. The boys who had to turn their money over to their parents turned over much more rapidly. It's rather interesting that boys who needed the money, came from families who needed the money, were least likely to succeed. The boys who had to turn the money over to their parents, obviously who needed their money, were less likely to succeed. The boys who had the decision, who had the option to spend their money as they saw fit, were more likely to be retained. You must predetermine what kind of person you're dealing with. Third, sell, don't debate. Watch good salesmen operate. Study some examples of good advertising. Do you see any debates in these forms of selling? If you do, then chances are the sales pitch isn't too effective. When you attempt to persuade somebody, you're performing the same kind of sales activity if you are selling a vacuum cleaner or cosmetics. The only difference is that you are selling an attitude instead of a product or a service. The basic principle of selling can be applied with good results. In fact, when it comes to persuasion, you might even improve on the standard sales technique. Whereas top salesmen prefer never to mention the competition on our successful, psychological research shows that in persuasion, you stand to gain by using the competition. You use the competition by anticipating opinions and reactions that are contrary to yours. Typically, you would anticipate a negative reaction to your proposal, then answer it fast and to proceed to make a strong case for yourself. Studies show that if you present only your side of the case, you have not really sold it. That's because when your audience hears the other side of the story, it will become more easily unconvinced than if it had heard both sides originally. Very important point here to remember. In other words, if you think that your audience originally heard, knows of, or even eventually will hear arguments against you, it will pay to devote some time to the opposition. Give your audience some mental ammunition with which to defend the position you hope it will take. It will also pay to anticipate the opposition if your audience is intelligent and sophisticated enough to look for flaws in your argument. Moreover, if you don't impress an intelligent audience by your knowledge of the competition, the audience may lose its respect for you and your case. You have to beat your audience at its own punch, its own best punch. The one-side argument works better when the audience is relatively uneducated and unsophisticated. Don't create doubts where none exist. Don't fix it unless it's broken. However, most of us are dealing with an increased educated population who will hear other arguments. Always open with a positive story in your selling, don't debating. Research by the late Dr. Carl Hovland at Yale pointed out the need to present the positive idea briefly. People seem to buy it without objection, consider stopping immediately. People sometimes freeze after the initial presentation, and the first idea presented often has greater impact than the concepts which follow. If an audience seems attentive but not overly responsive, outline the opposition's arguments. Don't make a strong case, obviously, for the opposition. Just mention enough of the negatives to alert your audience to their existence. The purpose is to insulate your audience against having the ideas penetrate from another unfriendly source. Then marshal all the facts in favor of your approach. present all the reasons why you're in favor of the idea, give this the special emphasis. Summarize. Hit your good idea first. Make a strong, positive statement. I am for Senator Norton's policies because he is the most honest, creative man, and his ideas will take this country out of the wilderness. However, there are some who will attack Senator Norton's record for the following reasons. I dismiss these reasons as irrelevant and then go on. One final suggestion on this sell, don't debate. Never identify an individual as a member of the opposition. This often makes him more resistant. He becomes intransigent, and you will make a sure enemy out of a possible ally. 4, stay in character. After a brief period of association, people such as your subordinates, your staff, your associates, learn what is expected. They know what is expected of you. If you get out of character when you try to persuade them, they'll become very suspicious, almost paranoid. An arousal of suspicion results in wasted persuasive effort. For example, a sudden burst of persuasive enthusiasm for an otherwise phlegmatic individual will doom him to failure. I have found that I get some criticism from speeches I make when I tell what is perceived by some as off-color stories. Yet the same stories can be told by another individual and they will get an uproarious response. I have discovered what I think is the problem, and that is that slang from a professor merely for the sake of talking to his fellows at their own level is almost certain to boomerang, because people do not expect that from a professor. Audience will lose respect for the professor and will naturally begin to suspect him of some ill-conceived plan. The character should stay, you should stay in character and stay honest. You'll never persuade people with phony techniques or pretending that so-called you're one of the boys. Next, avoid exaggerated platitudes. There are only two situations where persuasive exaggeration can be used to effect. One is in politics, which has the peculiar distinction of being a dead serious game. After the game, most participants forget and forgive their opponents. Under these circumstances, exaggeration is part of the fun. The other situation where persuasive exaggeration is effective is when you know in advance that your audience was with you from the time you first open your mouth. When individuals are convinced you are right from the start, then exaggeration will serve to reinforce their resolve and bolster their confidences. However, if there's any doubt as to how the audience stands, then you must avoid the advertising vocabulary, the exaggeration, and the platitudes. People simply do not respond to gross exaggeration. In fact, exaggeration is an excess that reflects poorly on both your judgment and your taste. If your idea or proposal is truly excellent, it should not be littled by exaggeration. One of the great Jesuit philosophers, Gracian, once said, true excellence is so rare that it should never be tainted by exaggeration. The sixth point I want to make is that we need to play down the fear theme in persuasion. Fear has some value in persuasion, but it has limited value. You must not depend on it to carry your total argument. A fear approach doesn't work because fear sometimes is used excessively. Stressing the consequences of one's acts rather than preventive measures may result in the avoidance of prevention. A far better approach is to use fear in mild doses plus heavy concentration upon prevention and caution. Men forget prevention when they become afraid because of the psychological defense mechanism known as denial. A man will deny the consequences of his own act, thus do nothing to prevent the consequences. For example, when you are driving and see a car cracked up alongside the road, you use denial. You may slow down for a moment, but then you quickly deny that such a thing could happen to you, and thus you resume your former speed. Rarely do your thoughts dwell on ways to prevent accidents, checking your brakes, aligning your steering, clearing your windshield, inspecting your tires. I get annoyed with highway safety programs which use fear excessively when announcing the auto death toll on national holidays. Like, you know, we have 1,000 deaths now on July 4th. You know, I keep wanting to go out there and make it an 1,001. The way the announcements are made, it sounds as if somebody hopes to make their quota. When I'm driving, I don't pay attention to those figures. I deny the possibility that I could become a statistic because the persuasion, the appeal, is made mostly on fear, not on prevention. Next, avoid pushing for immediate compliance in your persuasion messages. Pushing for immediate compliance sometimes works in, one, sex, when you want to take advantage of a present opportunity. Two, selling, when you want a man to put his name on the dotted line. Three, charity appeals, when tomorrow may be too late, like make your pledge now. But in most other situations, the push for immediate compliance will not have lasting results. It is okay if you're trying to inspire a man for the moment, but if you're trying to persuade a person to change his long-held habits or attitudes, don't demand immediate action. Give him a chance to think it over. Get the group behind you. When others have the same attitudes and philosophies as you, get them to lend you their supports. The deviants, those whom you're trying to persuade, cannot ignore the influences if others rally to your aid. When a person feels isolated from the mainstream of thinking around him, he gets tense and panicky. Tests have shown that a man will often betray his own good judgment in order to conform. 9, establish your expertness and authority. Do you argue with a doctor when he persuades you to have an operation? Most of us don't. Do you deny your auto mechanic when he persuades you to buy a new fuel pump? In both cases, you are being persuaded by experts with authoritative credentials. In both cases, their persuasion works. You can exert the same influence if you strive to establish your credentials as an expert. The public tends to believe experts. Witness the success of advertising based on testimony of experts, national heroes, authorities, prestige, and status figures such as athletes and entertainers. It isn't easy to establish yourself as an expert or authority. It takes time. In business, people come to respect your opinions with more conviction if you demonstrate that you have the ability and talent you say you have. Your subordinates must regard you as being worthy of their trust. A title of authority helps, but is no guarantee. A word of advice: never attempt to set yourself up as an authority in too many areas, or you will soon find yourself losing credibility in areas where you may rightfully be an expert. Many people tend to generalize their authority from one subject to another. 10, try to satisfy needs. All God's children have needs. If you can find out what is bothering your employees and try in some way to satisfy their needs, you will find it relatively easy to convince them to do as you wish. For example, if you know that a supervisor is in need of some ego building If you want to transfer him to another division, you might easily persuade him to make the change if you also agree to give him a fancy title. He will make changes willingly to satisfy his need for more status. This concept has been labeled by Mary Baker Follett as an integrated solution. Its essence lies in the facts that there are no losers. Instead of sacrificing your needs for someone else's or sacrificing his needs for yours, you develop a solution wholly acceptable to both. The persuader with the integrated solution has a large part of his argument won even before he presents his case. He has done his homework. Former great Chief Justice Earl Warren recognized the value of the integrated solutions in matters becoming before the Supreme Court. In a dedication speech at Fordham University, he said, "We are rarely called upon in the Supreme Court to resolve naked conflicts between freedom on the one hand and tyranny on the other. We are faced instead with conflicting demands of two or more competing interests, each apparently legitimate, which have run afoul of one another, and we must resolve such conflicts in a manner which will best preserve alike our strength, our democracy, and our individual liberty." 11, be sincere. 12, facilitate change. Make it easy to make the change. You may be on the verge of swaying a man to your side when he suddenly discovers that it is physically impossible to take the action you desire. So smooth the way. If, for example, you're trying to convince a New York executive to try his hand at managing a branch in Little Rock, Arkansas, send him or her down there for a week or so just to take a look at the situation. Show the individual how the branch is ready for rapid growth. Give them the sales figures. Give them literature on Arkansas to take back to their wife or husband. Have a new house all picked out and ready for inspection. Offer to move household effects at company expense. 13, provide recognition. Bulletin boards that display awards, company newspapers and magazines that carry photographs and stories about individual awards and presentation that recognize service are all part of the persuasion picture. Offer a man a concrete reward, show him that you recognize he may be making a sacrifice, and you are likely to convince him that he was right in agreeing to your suggestions. It is amazing how people to respond to symbols, plaques, certificates, framed letters. I have visited offices of many executives who frame their certificates and place them in honored positions for all to see. One vice president told me, "Our bishop does it beautifully. He hands out the plaques for last year's contributions, and then before the ceremony ends, he tells us what he expects for next year, and all of us begin again." 14, count the messages you send. If you want your important messages to count, count the messages you send. Do not overload the circuit. For the executive, solving the problem of intake is much easier than it is for the subordinate. The man on top can function comfortably by applying the principle of management by exception. Scott and Mitchell offer this sage advice. The exception principle states that only significant deviation from standards, procedures, and policies should be brought to the attention of the superior. Put it another way. Subsidiary units or subordinate individuals should handle all matters coming in their scope of jurisdiction. Thus, the superior should communicate with only on matters of exception and not of standard practice. The man downstairs, however, has no safeguard against the avalanche. His only hope is that his superiors will themselves serve as monitors screening out the unnecessary and the repetitious messages. Next, be enthusiastic. A moderate amount of flag waving is helpful. Convey the message that your project or idea is appealing. You must believe in something and demonstrate that belief through enthusiasm before you can be successful at persuasion. Your own enthusiasm is the best emotional lubricant for others. When they too become enthusiastic, they'll find it easy to agree. 16. Play up participation. Most individuals enjoy the pleasure of participation in a broadly defined project. This is well known to industrial psychologists. They frequently advise a man who must persuade another to use the team argument. This argument takes many forms, but always pushes the theme, you can help us. You can make a strong contribution if you will join our cause. We need you. In this context of company environments, Dr. Harry Levinson refers to the phenomenon of reciprocation. Reciprocation is the process of fulfilling one's expectation and gratifying one's needs in an organization. Psychologically, Levinson points out, man takes the company to himself. Reciprocation provides a source of self-esteem, support, and reward. 17. Make it public. Once a man tentatively agrees to your plan, ask him to put it on record. For example, you might suggest the executive announce a move to Arkansas by putting it on paper. Have the individual check with the personnel department about moving expenses. Ask to recommend someone to take their place. When you get the person to go on record like this, it will assure continuous agreement. Dr. Carl Hovland explains that once an individual has taken a stand on an issue, and everyone knows it, it becomes embarrassing and emotionally inconvenient to change back to the former view. Next, it is very important when you persuade to put your arguments in an effective fashion. Suppose you're invited as an executive, manager, an individual to deliver a speech next week. The average person is likely to hesitate, even if his calendar is empty. Make it 2 months hence, and he'll say yes, as if the sun will not rise as surely on that day of commitment. Later comes the trepidation. Actually, the art of delivering a good, persuasive speech in a manuscript or extemporaneously involves no secret recipes cooked up at the midnight hour while muttering incantations over a bubbling cauldron. Communication is subject to clear rules that are equally applicable to a manual on the factory maintenance, a handbook on sales techniques, or an innovation addressed to both a heavenly and an earthly audience at a testimonial dinner. The experts from Aristotle to Strunk and White are in complete agreement on these following propositions. A, clarity of theme. You're going to communicate clearly. William Zinsser, who teaches writing at Yale, puts it bluntly. I'll state as a useful rule of thumb that every successful piece of nonfiction should leave the reader with one provocative thought that he didn't have before. Not two thoughts or five, just one. It will not only give you a better idea of what route you ought to follow and what destination you hope to reach, it will affect your decision about tone and attitude. But don't let arithmetic of simplicity frighten you. A dozen elements may properly be included, provided they're all related to the single central thought you want to communicate. Says the Book of Proverbs, There be three things which are too wonderful for me. Yea, four, which I know not. The way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. No matter how many examples are bound together by one thought, the thought was, the way of the world is mysterious. To coherence, the separate strands that are woven into your theme must hang together. The key is order. Do not simply toss a handful of facts at your bewildered victims, expecting them to do your work and make a sense out of the jumble. It's your responsibility to arrange your ideas in a manageable sequence based on some system, logic, chronology, geography. Group together items that belong together, using words of linkage, like similarity, also, in addition, besides, where items are not related to each other but are relevant to your theme, use words of differentiation, but, nevertheless, on the other hand. Choice of words, very critical. English is rich with words and phrases that carry their own distinctive qualities. Unless you have a special thought-out reason for deviating, favor the particular as against the general. The particularizer doesn't eat fruit. He eats apples, oranges, apricots. I remember once having a conversation with Charles Revson. He said, I never use a word like perspiration. I use a word like I'm going to eliminate sweat. The power of particularity as compared with generality is demonstrated in one of the great masterpieces of modern speech and literature. I was a great lover of Winston Churchill, as I remember when I heard Franklin Roosevelt speak, I wanted to learn to speak. When I heard Winston Churchill speak, I wanted to give it all up. Winston Churchill's radio address to the British people after Dunkirk. The prosaic mind would have been satisfied with saying, if Nazis invaded England, we will defend every inch of our territory. Not Churchill. Remember with me, we shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it was subjected and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would struggle on the struggle until in God's good time the new world with all its power and might steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old. I love the words of John Fitzgerald Kennedy when he said, Churchill mobilized the English language and he sent it into battle. In the last analysis, however, the success of your ability to persuade as a writer or speaker will depend upon the three elements that Aristotle emphasized: projection of one's personality, i.e., the evidence of sincerity, an appeal to the emotions, a presentation of a logical line of thought. Next, I would like to address myself with you to the concept of how do you sell upstairs? How do you persuade your boss? I suspect, even though I put this as the 19th point, that it's one that is very critical. Many men succeed or fail by their ability to follow this recommendation, but I call it sending ideas upstream. Everybody's talking about heaven. Ain't going there, says the old spiritual. And so, too, every company that claims it wants new ideas is not necessarily receptive when people down below come up with suggestions. This blame is usually two-sided. More often than not, good ideas wind up in the waste bin of neglect because their proponents simply don't know how to merchandise them within the organization. At the very least, the would-be innovator should keep two facts in mind. One, attention getting. If you want to sell up ideas upstairs, your ideas don't get a hearing. Start with the assumption that it's your fault, that you have not communicated with your boss. The Russian novelist philosopher Dostoevsky may have overstated the case, but he does make the point dramatically when he says, if people around you are spiteful and callous and will not hear you, fall down before them and beg their forgiveness. For in truth, you are to blame for their not wanting to hear you. Certainly, if you're sincere in pushing your ideas, you have no right to adopt the view that Louis Armstrong expressed when somebody asked him to define jazz. Man, when you got to ask what it is, you'll never get to know it. It's up to you to focus attention on your proposal. Catch others' ears by stressing what your proposal will accomplish for those you're trying to persuade. Demonstrate how it will cut costs, save time, reduce expenditures of energy. Spell out how it will give your firm a competitive advantage. Show that it will correct a situation currently causing difficulty. Next, on selling ideas upward, make certain you have the right addressee. A letter that goes to the wrong recipient might just as well never have been sent. You can kill a good idea by ignoring the chain of command and going over the head of the person whose support is needed. Dr. Gordon Allport, the famous psychologist, has compressed a great deal of psychological wisdom into one sentence. He said, perhaps the basic principle of the science of human relations is that in order to deal effectively with another individual, you have to find out how he feels. You have to walk, as the Indians say, in his moccasins. Third, thorough research. Before you broach on the subject, be sure of your ground. The more often you have to say, I'll check that out, the weaker your case becomes. Give as much consideration to the cons as to the pros. Since any idea must have certain speculative value about it, know what is fact and what is opinion in your concept. Next, when you finally do get a hearing, be sure that you have prepared your presentation in a thoroughly logical fashion. Sequence of ideas is a major key. Determine beforehand which approaches you want to use. That is, do you want to use chronological, listing each point in time order? Do you want to go from the simple to the complex? Do you want to start with the main point and retract your steps, or a combination of all? Feedback. Don't let your eagerness to describe your proposition block you from hearing or seeing the response you are getting. The awareness of audience reaction doesn't require a sixth sense, only alertness to the other person. It may tell you when it's wise to persist, when it pays to go back to the drawing board, when it's a good idea to abandon the thought altogether. In any case, the experience will have to be worthwhile if you analyzed what went wrong and what went right. By the way, this whole enthusiasm about body language is nothing more than an attempt to see how you're getting on. And finally, another principle, our 20th, is a principle of effective communication is based upon the ability to avoid ambiguity in your messages by using terms in the same way your hearer does. The principal cause of misunderstanding may not be the words themselves. The cause may well be in the confusion in the minds of the communicator himself. Before you pass along an idea to someone else, you have to have a firm grip on it yourself. The use of broad language and sweeping generalities usually conceals a lack of detailed information. The best method of overcoming this failing is to force the mind to visualize the subject in physical images or symbols if necessary. Dr. W. Gray Walter, noted brain authority, attributes man's intellectual stature in the animal world and his ability to create visual representation of abstract qualities. One of the most distinguished marks of a great leader is the ability to translate concepts into figures of speech that the mind eye can almost literally see. Churchill again could explain his use clearly in vivid phrases like blood, sweat. Give us tools and we will finish the job. Wit, too, is found in the visual phrase. In a reply to a parliamentary adversary who was challenging the Prime Minister's refusal to reveal facts, Churchill once said, "The honorable member must not, in his innocence, take the bread from the mouths of the Soviet secret police." The importance of keeping your language as visible as possible is illustrated by the fact, often overlooked by executives and supervisors, that people have trouble even with specific mathematical descriptions unless they somehow become visual. Watch out for the executive pitfall of being too ambiguous. Keep it visual. We cannot leave this topic of persuasion until we get into the area of attitudes that affect productivity. We are constantly talking about the United States losing its race against foreign competition because we are unable to do a more effective job in productivity. Let me briefly give you some recommendations in this area. One of the problems in productivity loss is boredom. Back in 1969, Robert Nesbitt warned that authority was being undermined by a hitherto unsuspected factor. Boredom is one of the most dangerous accompaniments of a loss of authority in the social order. Between boredom and brute force, there is as close an affinity historically as there is between boredom and inanity, boredom and cruelty, boredom and nihilism. Boredom is one of the least understood, least appreciated forces in human history. A few years ago, Harlow Shapley listed boredom as third among the five principal possibilities of world destruction. Today, in the United States, it might seriously be considered first. One product of scientific management technique was boredom. And therefore, we need to understand that it is important that we comprehend this problem. Which of your employees are bored with the work? Is it due to the type of employees we have hired for that work? What aspect of the job are responsible for the boredom? Is it the repetitious factors? Is it the fragmentation of the job? Is it lack of clearly defined sub-goals that denote achievement even though the end result has not been reached? Consider the experience of an industrial engineer who noticed that workers were losing time by making several trips a day to the supply bin for more material. The logical seemed to be to move the bins closer to the operator's machine. This was done, but output dropped even greater. Finally, the bins were removed from sight. The production climbed back to normal. The explanation was simple. Just seeing the mass of raw materials suggested the endlessness of their jobs. You just don't seem to be getting anywhere. The best method of fighting boredom and thus enhancing authority and productivity is to provide a larger measure of human contact with fellow employees and supervisors and to stress the achievement of objectives. Two, on our need to understand and to change attitude towards productivity, we have to provide clear-cut goals. BFS testing service for young people has repeatedly confirmed the fact. It is clear that the older generation has ceased to press their children in terms of a career. What do you intend to be when you grow up was a familiar question in my generation. Now the tendency is to let people drift on the theory that there's plenty of time to decide. It is very important that we establish clear-cut goals and sub-goals for our people and our children in order to overcome the problem of our loss of productivity. I think it's necessary that on a long-range basis, we take a whole look at the problem of productivity through the framework of a loss of goals. Third, I think we need to introduce change. Change can be stimulating. It can be threatening. To win the fullest enthusiasm and cooperation from your people, you'll want to maximize the positive stimulation from change and minimize the threat of change. And I have tried to give you how to do this throughout this discussion. Let me just summarize. Here are six guidelines to introduce change, which could very well make a big difference in productivity of people, avoiding boredom and establishing goals. One, disseminate full information about a new project or assignment without endangering security. Take the risk of giving out too much information rather than too little. Two, show how the project ties in with the overall goals and health of the company. Experience tells us that we'll achieve better success if we emphasize how the speeded-up process will affect sales, production, customer relations. Next, talk to each key subordinate about his particular part of the new responsibility. Next, manifest your own enthusiasm. Make it clear that you feel the overall objective is a demanding and worthy one, and that you have confidence in the ability of the department to meet it. Five, set up a short-range goal for each individual. This should be goals that are reached fairly and quickly and that can be easily seen. Sixth, heighten contact and interaction with subordinates during the time that a new project is going underway. Talk to your people. Find out what problems they're running into. Help them straighten out their challenges. Pat them on the back for achievements. Make it clear to everyone that you are involved, that you are doing your share, and that we will increase our productivity and become more competitive in the world markets. One of the challenges in this whole area of persuading people comes into play when an executive is doing an interview. He has to either persuade the individual to take a promotion, persuade them to take a job, or persuade them to make a move. And I would like to give you some rule of the thumb recommendations, which I'd like you to consider in this crucible area of the interview. And I guess I'd really call it how professional interviewers do it, because I've been a professional interviewer for almost 30 years, and I want to give you some guidelines. First, I want to point out that the interview has got to be controlled by you. You must let the other person talk, but you must gently guide them to talk about the things you want to cover. The way to do this is by adroit questioning. The wrong kind of question can stop an interview in its tracks. Questions that require a premature yes or no answer that seem to put the other person on the spot, that indicate the questioner is thinking primarily of himself. These are types of inquiries that push the conversation to the dead end. Here are six questions that will let you control any interview, which becomes critical in your face-to-face communications. Here are briefly six prototype questions that, adapted to the circumstances, can control an interview and keep it in a desired path. One, what are your problems? Two, what would you like to see happen? Three, what do you see as actually happening? Four, how do you feel about the situation? Five, how can we work together to achieve the best possible results? And sixth, how do we go from here? Remember to put these things down the next time you're doing an interview. As a final point, I would like to give you one little bonus point. I always like to leave people confused a little bit, but confused at a higher level. We have been talking about the power of positive thinking. We have been talking in a very positive fashion. And now I'd like to talk to you for a moment or so about negative thinking. I'd like to talk to you about the power of negative thought or negative talking or negative persuasion. If you were suddenly asked to say which of the Ten Commandments comes first to your mind, what would you reply? Most people respond by saying, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery. Few would respond, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt have no other God before me, honor thy father and thy mother. We remember the specific negative prohibitions rather than some of the broad injunctions. The fact that our mind works this way has a bearing for managers on the handling of people. I was talking to the president of a sporting goods company about one of his key executives. The president said he's a talented guy, but sometimes he's such a louse that I believe he creates more headaches than he's worth. He's touchy and emotional, insulting and sarcastic, and he keeps on interfering in other departments where he has no business interfering. The subject of our conversation is a gifted manager whose absence would be sorely felt. So he asked what was the president doing to help him get straightened out. Well, said the president, I've talked to him. Of course, I try to keep the thing on a very positive level. I've emphasized his good points and try to make it clear to him what I'd like him to be. To be a really top-notch executive, he should be understanding, calm, tactful, etc. And when he talks, he agrees with me, but then he goes out and does the same things. I believe that positive thinking may have been carried too far. In cases like this, a small dose of negative thinking would be effective. We suggested to the president that instead of putting out the do's, he put out a bunch of don'ts. Don't insult people publicly. Don't keep telling people how good your department is. Don't bang on the table. Don't tell other people how to run their departments. Don't call meetings. Don't talk to anybody when you know you have a chip on your shoulder. At the first, the president cringed, but then he did it, and it's amazing. It paid off. I am not suggesting the abolition of positive precepts, or that the Ten Commandments should be rewritten into a decalogue of don'ts. But we do suggest that specific undesirable behavior can often be changed more by saying thou shalt not rather than saying thou shalt. For example, take the employee who is frequently late. You can try the positive approach. No, you'll make every effort to be on time, but you'll do better with the negative sometimes. Len, don't be late. Do people resent the negative? Not nearly as much as managers fear. As a matter of fact, many workers welcome negatives. They are clear and easy to remember.